One evening, I was in the boundary waters between Canada and the United States, north of Duluth. The day had been one of portaging canoes and supplies and of paddling against the wind. When we finally got camp set up, we were drawn to the beach to bathe. As night fell, we stayed glued to the beach, watching the northern lights. It was though all the work of the day was being repaid in millions by the heavens. White lights cascaded down from the dome of the stars, shimmered in sheets, and flashed upon the darkness. We were exhausted but unable to leave the site to go to bed. When Lewis and Clark and their party, about whom all of you I'm sure know a lot more than I do, arrived where the Columbia River met the sea, they were similarly entranced. Before their eyes stretched waters to the horizons, gold circled and otters feasted. To reach this point, they had labored for 18 months, rowing and walking from St. Louis across the Rockies and down rivers of which they had only faint traces on old maps or in legends. They had come through territory peopled with sometimes welcoming and sometimes hostile groups. They had traveled through forests and mountains from which they could only hope they would emerge. They had lost one of their number along the way, and the rest were tired and often hungry. But they had uncovered, both on their way to the sea and on their trek home, unknown species of plants, animals, and customs of human beings that no one of their heritage had seen before. They kept meticulous notes, both diaries of their actions and records of their discoveries that would become treasures for generations to come. Although they moved through little traveled territory, today there's only one pass that they took that has not been converted to a road for automobiles. High in the mountains in Idaho, the Lewis and Clark Pass is still 1.5 miles from any roadway. And if one crouches low on the ground in the setting sun, one can still see the ruts left by generations of travel, poles between which were slung pelts to hold supplies that had been pulled by dogs or humans and then by horses in the days after the Spanish reached the plains. The person who set them on this trek, Thomas Jefferson, had both political reasons and curiosity behind his request of Congress to finance the expedition. He knew that Spanish, French, and other nationals were interested in marking this land for themselves, and the British were interested in claiming sole authority in order to dominate the fur trade. And in those days, the first explorer had a lot of influence over who could claim the land, of course, in the European tradition of claiming it. This convinced Congress to fund the expedition. As an interesting aside, opposition to Jefferson was so high in the Congress, does this sound familiar, that he had to go about this in a behind their backs proposal. But Jefferson was also interested in the content of these lands. What were they like? Who lived there? What plants and animals flourished there? Meriwether Lewis was given training before he left in botany, how to identify new plants and how to record them for scientists. He was also given training in rudimentary medicine by Universalist physician and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, in order to keep his crew healthy as he went. The point was for them to survive and to tell their tales. And an astronomer had taught him how to navigate by the stars. This last fall, I went to Monticello, Jefferson's home in Virginia, which has been restored as closely as possible to what it was there when Jefferson died. One enters a foyer about 3/4 as big as this room, and it's a museum hung with war bonnets, animal heads, tools for the hunt, etc. It is what Meriwether Lewis had bought home to his patron. And how exotic it must have seemed to the diplomats visiting with Jefferson after the expedition. They had never seen the ceremonial headpiece made of feathers and leather that we call a war bonnet, and the paintings on buffalo hide depicting battles and hunts. I wonder what their reactions were to the stories relayed by Jefferson from the notes of Lewis and Clark. In Jefferson's garden were planted seeds that are still planted there today, brought back from the plains and the mountains. He declared that Indian corn, as he called it, was fit for consumption and could even be tasty. Before the expedition, at Jefferson's invitation, Meriwether Lewis was invited to come spend many hours in the library at Monticello. Jefferson owned the largest collection of books in the world, of maps, etc., about the land west of the Mississippi. All of these mark a long and well thought out preparation for a long journey of discovery. Over the next year and a half, you too will be taking a journey. It won't involve canoes, which is a relief to some and a disappointment to others, I'm sure. But it will involve discovery and has a huge reward at the end, an even more amazing picture of what the future of this congregation and the religious lives of each of you will look like in the years to come. You are first going to choose an expeditionary crew. Jefferson chose Lewis, and Lewis chose his friend Clark. Lewis was a military man and thus could recruit people who were used to traveling in harsh conditions and eager to go where no one among them had gone before. And joining the crew at the headwaters of the Missouri was a Frenchman married to a Shoshone Indian woman named Sacagawea. She was only 18 when they started and gave birth almost immediately to a son. The woman and the child were to prove an asset to the otherwise all-male crew. She not only could converse with some of the tribes they would meet, but the presence of a woman and baby made sure the group was not mistaken for a war party. You are going to choose members of your congregation to form a team that will search for the person they think should be your next minister. As such, these people need not be adept at paddling canoes or speaking languages such as Mandan and Lakota Sioux, but they do need to be knowledgeable about this congregation, how it works, and what its dreams are. And they will need to get along with each other and be able to spend considerable time at this task over the next 18 months. You will need detail people and visionaries. You will not need people who are attached to only one aspect of this church, say religious education or Sunday services or social action or music or denominational affairs, or who just think it would be fun to belong to the search committee. I hope the people who belong think it would be fun to belong to the search committee, but they need more. You need people who are dedicated to the whole church and its various ministries, even if they're more familiar with one aspect than another. All of Lewis's and Clark's people had to be able to paddle a canoe, carry heavy loads, and follow orders. Your crew will determine its own directions, but each will need that basic dedication and self-discipline in order to do this job well. And your crew will have great maps to take them across this landscape. Besides a good handbook, the UUA has provided people trained in leading search processes to help you. Lisa Presley will be your district staff person while you're on this journey, and I will be your map expert. Others will give you help in determining search committee expenses, ministerial salary requirements these days, opening your eyes to the advantages of diversity in ministerial styles and backgrounds, and tools for uncovering the breadth and depth of this congregation's wants and needs. Your interim minister, Reverend Wolf, will be able to get you in touch with someone to address your every need as it comes up. Many years ago, it dawned on the Unitarian Universalist Association that congregations may not know how to conduct a search for a minister. Duh. What a thought. It's something that many of you will experience only once in your lives, and why should you remember how to do it? So the association began to set up a system to help you. That's where all the people I named before come in. And one by one, it was discovered that expertise in each of these areas helped congregations make the best choices for themselves. And of course, helped ministers to make the best choices for themselves too, because this is a two-way search. Ministers are searching as you are searching. They're looking at you as you're looking at them. When Lewis and Clark departed, they were supplied with sufficient black powder and lead for flintlock firearms, blacksmithing supplies, and cartography equipment. They carried flags, gift bundles, medicine, and other items they would need for their journey. Your team will be supplied with a copy of the Settlement Handbook for Ministers and Congregations. It contains timelines for each of the tasks, outlines of the tasks, and the reasons for them, and a set of frequently asked questions in the back. Think of it as your map. The congregation can have access to this handbook in order to know what's happening, but your committee will work in confidence. When Lewis and Clark disappeared up the waters of the Missouri River, they had essentially no communication with their government or president. Your search committee will inform you of where they are in the process every step of the way. But the names of ministers with whom they are conversing will not be revealed. This protects two bodies involved in this process. The ministers can apply knowing that their own congregations and other congregations with whom they are conversing will not be privy to the process. Ministers are not stupid. When we are going to move on, we frequently don't tell the congregation we're in just in case you don't find another place. And then your own congregation is like, what? What? You have to come back? No, it's usually in confidence up to a certain point. And the congregation, in the end, will be presented with one candidate to vote up or down. This prevents splits within the congregation over which of the ministers being considered would be best for this group. And I have been privy to other groups that don't narrow it down to one candidate and watch congregations explode in the process. So that's why we do it this way. As Lewis read over a month in Jefferson's library, so your search committee will do a survey of the congregation. And this is your chance to speak out early in the process. The survey takes time to fill out, but your voice will be included in the results if you participate. When the last church I was in did a survey, they put it on SearchMonkey, and they warned everyone that, you know, with SearchMonkey, once you sit down and start it, you can't leave the table and come back. They warned everyone it would take 45 minutes to finish it. It's very thorough. The survey will ask who you are as a person, about your expression of your beliefs, about what you would value the most in a new minister, etc. And the survey has been written and refined over the years by those professionals involved in the search process. Each congregation uses the same survey, and thus ministers have a good field of comparison for understanding the uniqueness of each group that they are considering. This is indeed a two-way choice. The ministers can choose which congregations they want to speak to, as I said, and the congregations can both select the minister they want to consider and then vote whether or not to accept that candidate. Either side can turn down the other anywhere in the process. It almost never happens. So it is important to select search team members who can have tough conversations, who can keep confidence, and who are dedicated to finding the best fit for all areas of the church's activity. They will need to do reference checks. What I say is reference checks, reference checks, reference checks, reference checks. And some people are very timid about that. So you need at least a couple of people on this search committee that will get on the phone and ask anybody anything. No one person will be fully adept at every area of ministry. None of the ministers will be. People just aren't like that, are they? And ministers are, what a shock, are actually people. So the survey will give your search committee clues as to which talents are most important to you and which kind of personality you work best with. When this service is over, I will meet with the board of your congregation to talk about their role in this process and to lay out several effective ways a search committee can be nominated. We talked on the phone about this already. The board then selects the system. And when you have elected a search committee, when you have chosen the people with which you wish to place your trust for this endeavor, then I will return to meet with them, and then off you go. My role, I think of myself as the person who can converse in several languages, in Bostonian, in Altonese, in congregational, and in committee. I know the way up the Missouri River and westward across the mountains. I've been there before. Sound like Sacagawea? Does to me. I'm not 18, though. That was a long time ago. So let's get the crew assembled and take off on this journey into the unknown. And I can hardly wait to see the sea stretching before you, open-ended and populated with wonders as you greet your new minister.